Hello, good afternoon, bon 14 juillet, and welcome to today's episode of Resounding Echoes. I consider that music is, by its very nature, essentially powerless to express anything at all, whether a feeling, an attitude of mind, a psychological mood, a phenomenon of nature, etc. Expression has never been an inherent property of music. That is by no means the purpose of its existence. If, as is nearly always the case, music appears to express something, this is only an illusion and not a reality. It is simply an additional attribute which, by tacit and inveterate agreement, we have lent it, thrust upon it, as a label, a convention. In short, an aspect which, unconsciously or by force of habit, we have come to confuse with its essential being. So wrote Igor Stravinsky in 1936, a man who knew a thing or two about music. Now, some may consider this a preposterous or at least controversial statement. I think Stravinsky hit the nail right on the head, both in his consideration that music is incapable of expression and his assertion that so much of what we think and say about music is an illusion caused by cultural convention and lazy thinking that we foist upon it, and says little or nothing about the real nature of music. But let's look at each of those two points separately for the sake of clarity. For the first, it's very important to be clear about what we understand by music. Everybody knows what music is, but ask anyone to define it or explain it, and it is far from straightforward. For my purposes today, I want to separate sound from music. Now, by sound, I mean the strictly physical reality of what happens when two objects come into contact with each other. Whether that be a tree falling in a forest, a bow rubbing against a string, two pairs of lips locking and unlocking, blowing a horn, or a drum being beat. In all these examples, repeated cyclical vibrations pass through the air in the form of sound waves. The greater the rate of repetition in a given time frame, the higher the frequency. What we perceive as difference in pitch in these sound waves is a matter of velocity. The faster you vibrate, the higher the pitch. Now, perceive is the key word here. Sound waves occur whether we perceive them or not. But sound does not become music until it comes into contact with our biological hardware, namely our ears, from where it travels to our brains, which as the center of our central, well, obviously the name is there, as the center of our nervous systems, create the experience that we call music. Now, by this definition, music is not a self-contained, independent reality, but rather an interaction, or the result of the interaction between sound waves and our central nervous systems. If anything is expressed in this interaction, obviously it has to come from the source, which is sound. Now, the notion that sound waves oscillating repeatedly through the atmosphere can be melancholic or romantic or joyful, or that they can evoke a desert island or a sense of despair, to me is self-evidently ludicrous. As I have defined it here, music is more a matter of impression than expression, and what impression music makes is to a great extent dependent on the personal and cultural perspective of each individual listener, i.e. something totally beyond and independent from the physical reality of sound and even the intentions of a composer. When somebody says this is happy music, what they really mean is that the music in question makes them feel happy. You might say that I am splitting hairs here and that happy music and music that makes you feel happy are the same thing. But I don't agree. Sitting here, I am as aware as anybody of how difficult it is to talk about music. So for that reason, when we can talk clearly about it, which is very rare, The onus is on me and all of us to do so. Music cannot be happy or sad or romantic or terrifying. It can only be fast or slow, loud or quiet, low frequency or high frequency. Composers construct compositions with pitch, meter, rhythm, themes, chords, instrumental color and forms, not with feelings and moods. Music expresses nothing except music. When we use adjectives pertaining to human emotions, we are saying next to nothing about the reality of sound and talking exclusively about our emotional impressions that these sounds make on us, which, and this brings us to our second point in Stravinsky's opening quote, sounds, well, the impressions that sound makes on us are dependent on accumulated subjective experience and cultural convention to a degree that I think few genuinely contemplate or realize, and also due to a dearth of other verbal means by which to talk about music. This inability to talk sensibly about music is not the fault of sound, but wholly our own. One would hope that we would have learned a lesson from Wittgenstein, namely that if you can't talk sensibly about something, it is best not to talk about it at all. It seems that fewer and fewer people listen to music without some kind of accompaniment, whether that be as a background hum for dancing, supermarket shopping, housework, or being put on hold. Music today is so often accompanied by the visual that people don't realize how much their impressions of the music are manipulated by these images. Movie soundtracks are the obvious example, but television and advertising play a huge role here also. The degree of manipulation, and more importantly, the lack of any objective expression in music, can be proved by using the same piece of music to accompany vastly different images in vastly different emotional contexts without any seeming incongruity. It is all about context. Nothing is inherent to the sounds. And just to give a few examples on that last point, one that comes to me is when I think of possibly the most terrifying film I've ever seen. Is a film called The Haunting. It's an English film from the 1960s. I won't get into it here, but if you want to know what it's about, then go and watch it, if you dare. But yeah, I said it is a terrifying film, and a big part of what makes it so uncomfortable to watch is the music. But the music was composed by great English composer Humphrey Searle. And I have listened to the soundtrack many, many, many times without the movie, just as music. And I adore it. And I've listened to it in the dark. I've listened to it many times in many situations. And it's never, ever remotely frightened me or terrified me. And in fact, I don't even remember, even when I listen to the music, I don't even think I think about the film at all. So, yeah, so when I thought the first time I heard that film that the music was part of the reason I felt so scared, I don't believe so now at all. Or also, I think I listen to a lot of traditional music, ethnographic music from all over the planet. And there are many, many, many sounds, forms of music, very dissonant ideas of melody, music that is not based on the tempered scale that we use here in the West, that we have used here in the West for at least the Middle Ages, very asymmetrical rhythms, just very different ideas of instrumental color. Basically, a lot of sounds that a lot of people in the West would find very unpleasant and uncomfortable to listen to. But in their natural setting, for the people who make these sounds and for whom they are very important, I don't want to say enjoy, because a lot of music has a religious or quasi-religious place in many cultures around the world. But obviously, for the people who make the music, there is nothing inherently unpleasant or strange about the sounds that they are used to. as I said. And another one, for example, I recently read somebody saying that they had no problem to accept that Arno Schönberg was a genius and that his influence on 20th century music was undoubted. But the person who was writing said, we have to start from the premise, though, that Schönberg's music is horrible to listen to. And I had to laugh because I find Schönberg's music extremely beautiful to listen to. And I mean beautiful. I don't respect Schönberg's music or admire it. I do. Well, I admire and respect him more than the music. But I find him, I love the music. I find it extraordinarily beautiful and ever more so. In fact, the piece of Schönberg's music that I find least beautiful is Verklärte der Nacht, because I think it's, of all his works, it's probably the most cliched and the least, I mean, it's obviously a piece of music he wrote, but it's, for me, it's too much based on his influences. But I'm giving all these examples just to show how subjective ideas about music are, and also how personally subjective and how culturally dependent they are. So, but following on from this, one positive aspect of the fact that music can't and doesn't express anything in an objective or in any real sense is that by corollary, it can express anything any individual wants it to. This is an example of that profoundest and most magical mystery of the artistic experience of how feeling is transformed into meaning in a very real but at the same time paradoxically very amorphous sense. All this brings me to today's first piece of music. It's a piece I am going to interpret in a wholly subjective fashion, which I am certain was a long way from the composer's intention. Once a work of art enters the public domain, what it means is wholly beyond the creator's control. Whether or not a creator even has the right to such interpretive control is a can of worms that will have to wait on the already well-stocked shelf of canned worms here at Resounding Echoes. But enough about worms, I want to talk about chicks. I recently spent quite a bit of time watching a blue-tit chick learning to fly. And this experience came back to me when I listened to our first piece of music for today. One of the distinguishing features of 20th century music is its escape from the strict bounds of tonality. Now, tonality can be thought of as an elastic, although it can be stretched and pulled in various directions and to varying degrees, must always come back to its original starting position. Now, throughout the late 19th century, certain composers were stretching this elastic further and further in a search for ever-increased expressive means to reflect an ever-changing reality around them. Now, those who came after composers like Wagner and Liszt, who likewise sought ever greater expressive means or appropriate means in a world that had been turned upside down by radical and relatively rapid changes and advances. Well, the advances can be argued, because when I hear talk of advance or progress, I always ask myself, progress for who or whom or what? But there were definitely rapid changes in technology, communication, transport, work, city life, social interaction, science, not to mention a world in which God had died on a Thursday just after breakfast, and so many seemingly eternal certainties about morality, race, sex, class, identity, behavior, crime, war, conquest, the meaning of life, all of these things were now all open to heroic doubt and radical questioning, thanks in no small part to the ideas of Marx, Darwin, Nietzsche, Freud, Einstein, and many others. Now, these composers, the generation after, especially Wagner and Liszt, understood that the logical next step was to stretch the elastic of tonality until it could no longer bear the tension and let it snap, thus emancipating dissonance and allowing all those hitherto wrong notes to pour forth in a surge of intensely heightened and newly discovered expression. However, as with many of the old long-standing ideas, whether the divine right of kings, that some are born to rule, some are born to serve, that the white is superior to the black, that women are by nature inferior to men, that homosexuality is an abomination, that atheists are in league with Satan, that art must express the truth of Christian morality, and so on, tonality was not going to disappear overnight. Indeed, many were prepared to fight and fight bitterly to make sure it never disappeared or lost its dominant position, which finally brings me back to my tit. I use the analogy of an elastic to talk about tonality. Another appropriate one would be gravity. Tonality affects a gravitational pull on music. And atonality, in a sense, is a defiance of gravity in a way similar to flight. Now, my conceit about our first piece of music for today is that it is like a diary detailing a composer experimenting hesitantly, uncertainly, with the intoxicating yet unnerving possibilities of atonality, similar to how a chick bound by instinct makes its first hesitant, uncertain attempts at flight. The chick in question, the one I was watching anyway, it frantically flaps its wings, it hops hopefully, it manages to get off the ground for an instant every now and again, but it remains earthbound. Now, we have just heard a part of the first movement of the fourth piano sonata by Alexander Scriabin, which he finished composing in the year 1903. Now, this piano sonata is in two movements, but they are joined together, and it is the very hinge of these two movements that, in my far-flung interpretation, is akin to the very moment when the birds, or the chick's biology, and the play of physics come magically together in the first moment of genuine flight. There seems to be a moment of almost pure joyous shock when the chick realizes it is actually able to defy gravity, and if not quite soar, at least levitate. Towards the end of the piece, the mastery of flight becomes more evident, and ultimately the chick seems to exult in its newfound, new-fledged, ecstatic liberty. Thank you. Many birds, once they fledge, never return home to their parents' nest, but not all. I've seen kestrels, for example, come back over several days to their original nest long after they have mastered flight. Maybe it is because they still have not mastered hunting. I don't know. I'm just speculating. Maybe this reticence is more typical of birds of prey. When your diet consists solely of seeds and creepy crawlies, getting a meal involves less learning and practice. And just as the kestrel returns home, Scriabin, in this piano sonata, despite all its dizzying adventures and fluttering experimentation, does likewise, and it finishes on a comforting, resounding, if somewhat disappointing, F major chord. Knowing that he can defy gravity, but maybe not yet fully confident in his ability to do so permanently, or still fearful of what the consequences might be if he untethers the rope that keeps him bound in orbit. It is a lonely, dark, cold new universe out there. Now, for my second piece of music, and for the day that's in it, I thought I would have to play something French. So let's have something. Now, that was a part of an impromptu which Gabriel Fauré wrote, obviously for the harp, a piece he wrote in the year 1904. And although I have never, it's not a radical piece of music, but I have never heard it, although I would love to. But I once got very close to hearing it, but I just, I was in the position to hear it, but I just didn't have the time to listen to the concert. I remember it was about 20 years ago, one Friday morning when I was working, I had to go to the National Gallery in Dublin on an errand, and while I was waiting for one of the workers in the gallery to help me with something, I had a few minutes to kill, so I went for a, so I started swanning around the place. And I eventually ended up one of the main galleries, which had been set up for that Friday's lunchtime concert, which was typical in the National Gallery back then. I don't know if that's still the case. But as I entered that room, there just so happened that there was a harpist tuning up. And I stood there entranced, I remember, for I don't know how long, because I just thought, I wrote a piece before called The Home Country Grown Strange, dedicated to music for the harp. It is my favorite instrument. And just listening to somebody tuning it up was magical in itself. But after a few minutes, I did notice that there was a program on every individual seat. And I took one up and I looked, and sure enough, this impromptu for harp, the only one that Fauré wrote, he wrote another 5 impromptus for piano. But this was on the concert. And while I was looking at the program, the harpist actually stopped tuning and asked me if I was going to be at the concert, and I said I would love to, but unfortunately I had to get back to work and I just didn't have the time to to listen to the concert. But then I said, do you mind if I ask you a question? And she said, no, of course I don't. And I said, listen, I know this piece by Fauré. I love it. But I've always had the feeling that maybe it's not so well written for the harp. I didn't know exactly how to explain it, but I just had the feeling that some of it was a bit cluttered, or I was going to say clumsy, but who am I to call Gabriel Fauré clumsy? But I don't know. I just had the sense that maybe if the fingering had been better, it would have come off more or something like that. So I asked her and she said musically it's very well written, but she told me that it's noticeable that Fauré was not a harpist. And this was the first piece he wrote for harp, and he wrote one more later on, about another 10 or 12 years later. I think, no, 1918, he wrote a second piece for harp. But I think for this piece, he wrote this as a commission. It was for an exam at the Paris Conservatoire. And I also don't think he had the time, because it was a commission for a particular setting. I don't think he had the time to finish it the way he wanted to. So maybe it's not fair. But she did tell me, yes, that some of it doesn't sit so well on the harp. And Fauré himself did later transpose this impromptu for piano also. So maybe you can go and listen to the piano one to compare. But that's it. So I think that's all I have for today. I hope you took something for that. Thanks for listening. And remember, keep tuning in to those, or for those, Echoes of Oblivion. Ah, I almost forgot. There is also an ornithological connection with the Fauré impromptu, in that if you look at the score of that piece, particularly the beginning of the fragment which I played, it actually looks like a bird about to take flight, or maybe a bird that has just swooped down onto the score. So not only is it beautiful to listen to, it's actually quite beautiful to look at. And one other thing, also in connection with the piece I wrote about harp music last year, I have one old recording of that piece. It's not the one I've played today, but it's on an old French EMI LP. And in the liner notes, when they're talking about the harp, they call it notre instrument, our instrument. Well, this is something else. The version of the piece that I just played there was played by a Welsh harpist, Catherine Finch. Wales is a country which has a long tradition of harp music. And when the French talk about the harp as our instrument, well, if you happen to have any euros, or if you find a big bag of euros, if you dip your hand in and take them out, if you find any harps on the euros, I can guarantee you they won't be French.